Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest tonight is a very special guest, because without this man, there would be no Random Trek. You may think it's Jason Snell, but it's not. Of course, without him, there would be no Random Trek either. Hi, Jason, if you're listening. But the person here has an even more immediate impact on every episode of Random Trek. It's Jim Metzendorf. Jim, thanks for joining me.
Permission to board, Captain Scott.
Granted. Now, many people don't know, all the guests actually on the podcast know, but Jim, you edit every episode of Random Trek. So without you, we would not have a podcast.
I do. And in fact, this is already kind of surreal and perhaps a bit weird because finally the radio is talking back to me, Scott. I don't understand what's happening.
Few people understand what's happening when they talk to me.
I might be hallucinating like 7 of 9.
What? Have you been alone for a month? Does that make me the doctor? Which I'm okay with because I like the doctor.
Yeah. But,
or I could be that weird alien that she hallucinates.
Yeah, we got to talk about that creeper.
We do. Now, Jim, before we jump into the episode, tell the people a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, I am a, among other things, nerd.
Yes.
And freelance audio and video editor, mm-hmm. Predominantly of podcasts. I edit shows for you and Jason, specifically Random Trek, as you mentioned. I also do work for Clayton Morris and his stable of shows. I edit the Macworld podcast, and most recently I've started editing the iMore show for Rene Ritchie and Android Central for Phil Nickenson.
You are just expanding your empire of podcast editing.
I do what I can.
Do well, what we I all can. Appreciate it. Because editing, we were talking before we started recording, but editing something that includes your own voice is one of the special circles of hell, I think. The only worst thing, I had a video podcast for a while before video podcasts were a thing, and it was a cooking show that with my wife, who wasn't my wife at the time, but is now. And editing video of yourself is worse than editing audio of yourself, because then you get to see all the stupid faces that you make.
Oh, yeah.
It's awful.
Yeah.
But let's editing is not what we're here to talk about. Although you do a great job of editing, Jim, so thank you for that. And now when I have notes for you for this episode, I can just tell you.
Right.
which is great. We're here to talk about Star Trek. Now, you said you're a geek and a nerd, but you consider yourself a Star Trek fan.
Scott, I love Star Trek. Maybe a little too much.
Is such a thing possible?
Well, if it is, then I'm hovering dangerously close to the neutral zone.
Ooh.
of inappropriate Star Trek love.
How does your inappropriate Star Trek love manifest itself? I'm very curious.
Well, that's a good question. There were so many action figures, Scott.
Oh, yes.
So many action figures in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So many trips to the store to find the short-packed Playmate Star Trek figures,
mm-hmm.
you know, finding the removable visor Geordi LaForge's.
Well, you want the removable visor one, because otherwise you're just wasting your money.
Exactly. Exactly. See, you understand the...
I get it.
You understand this. And then there were the white border and black border Star Trek, the customizable card game.
Oh, you're speaking my language now.
Yes.
I was never big into action figures, although I like action figures. People give me Star Trek action figures as presents because it's an easy present, and I appreciate it. I'm more of a ship fan, so I like the models of the ship, so I have lots of ship models. But I have thousands of Star Trek, the customizable card game cards. I went a bit crazy with them.
Those were a lot of fun, and I still remember going to conventions in the 90s and seeing some of those cards for $50, $100 each.
Mm-hmm.
And now I have no idea what the interest and worth of them now is, but let's just assume safely so, I would imagine, that they are worth less.
What? I have invested all of my money in these cards.
Yes.
Do you recall they came out with the special silver border cards?
Yeah.
Oh, that was a very exciting moment.
Yeah.
This is, unfortunately for me, or fortunately for, well, fortunately for Decipher, I suppose, the Star Trek The Customizable Card Game came out shortly thereafter I discovered the phenomenon of eBay. And so I spent a lot of money when I was in college, and I didn't have a lot of money when I was in college, on a lot of Star Trek cards. So it was fun to go to the student center, open up my mailbox, which never had anything in it except for packages from random places across the United States, and cards of Star Trek.
Yep.
It's very exciting.
Yep. Good times.
So I think that's entirely appropriate. I think it's inappropriate. I'm sure you have seen Trekkies with what's her face, Denise Crosby.
Yep.
It profiles a lot of very enthusiastic, let's say, Star Trek fans.
Yes.
The one who sticks in my mind is the woman who walks around. You know, I'm not judging. Although I think this is slightly inappropriate, but if it brings you joy, go on, shine on, you crazy diamond. But she was like on the Whitewater trial or something like that, and she showed up in her Starfleet uniform.
Yeah, yeah, I do remember her, and maybe there are some boundaries, and maybe they're not.
You know, who am I to tell her what to wear? Yeah. I just think for me, that's going too far. But clearly for her, that's well within her comfort zone. So,
yeah.
Good for her. Plus, as I've said before on this podcast, I would not look very good in a Starfleet uniform. So I have never been tempted to buy or wear a Starfleet uniform. Just because it's a favor I do for everyone else. I'm trying to.
As do I. For the benefit of all mankind, I do not cosplay.
Exactly. Although, yes. I've talked about this with other people on this very podcast, that I think there are certain things I could cosplay as. A Klingon. I think I'm built for a Klingon, because the Klingons are a warrior race, but a lot of them are a little out of shape.
Yeah.
I've noticed.
I'm right with you. Believe me.
So believe I feel I could slide into the Klingon Empire and be a Klingon warrior.
Yeah.
Probably I would be a ceremonial guard. I'm not saying I'm good at fighting, but I could wear that uniform and look intimidating with that makeup on.
Yeah. I'm just still trying to figure out how I could get my prescription eyeglasses on over the nose ridge and the forehead ridge.
I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah, until I can personally tolerate contacts, I think I'll still have to rule it out. But yeah, believe me, you're speaking my language.
I also wear glasses, and I cannot put contacts in. So that would be a stubbly block on my road to Klingon warriordom. I have not seen any bespeckled Klingons in my copious Star Trek watching.
Yeah.
But there must be one somewhere, probably on the Klingon homeworld.
I'll bet you General Chang has a good monocle.
He probably does.
Yeah, to go along with his eye patch.
But oddly enough, he wears it over the eye, or he wears it under the eye patch, so right. we never see it. That's, yeah. He's so ashamed of it.
This monocle has no honor.
That's right. He's read so much Shakespeare that his eyesight has suffered. As I've also noticed while watching lots of Star Trek, Klingons have a very definite style, and that style, part of that style is poor lighting. Klingons hate well-lit spaces.
This is true.
So it's really hard to read when you're a Klingon, because nobody wants a reading light. But anyway. So speaking of Klingons, let's talk about Star Trek series. And my question that I ask every Star Trek person, well, not every Star Trek person, but any person who happens upon this podcast as a guest, your favorite series. If you had to pick one, which you do, because I'm asking you, which would you pick?
Well, I've been thinking about this for quite some time, because I knew that this was coming.
You knew one day you would be called
Yes.
From
the minor leagues.
No. I was trying to think of back of the house, right. Or backstage and the dark recesses of the production studios, of the vast Random Trek production studios. I would come out of my office with that cigar and say, "You kid, I'm going to make you a star."
Yeah. I'm going to go with Star Trek The Next Generation.
Ah.
Now, I grew up watching the original series in syndication, in the late 70s and 80s. I am an individual of a certain age that is very slightly above 40.
Oh, all right.
41. So
that is very slightly above 40. I am 38. I'll be 39 later in February. So.
Oh, okay. So we're right around the same age. Mm-hmm. And so coming up, original series was a big part of my childhood. Saturdays were often filled with mini marathons on Channel 43 WUAB in Cleveland. The local kind of independent station, but they were the ones who all ultimately would bring the Next Generation to the market here in Northeast Ohio. And I can remember actually watching the first episode of Next Gen, and to be honest, it didn't really grab me.
Oh, Encounter at Farpoint Station.
Yeah, it didn't do a whole lot for me.
And that's I like The Next Generation, but that is a weird first two-parter episode.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And so it wasn't until a couple of seasons later that I really started getting into Next Generation. Now, this is kind of a side tangent, but it does relate to why Next Gen ended up being my favorite series and the one that I spent the most time with. Although I think that I have seen every episode of every Star Trek. Mm-hmm. Although it's possible that I have missed one or two along the way.
There are a lot of episodes to keep track of.
There are many. And certainly at this point, it would be difficult to just out of my memory, cite particular episodes. But anyways, so my dad had a satellite dish. And one of the cool things that you could do with a satellite dish before the era of everything being encrypted signals and all of this stuff was you could tune in to certain satellites and watch syndication feeds for TV shows. And Next Generation was one of those such shows. So we had this big old satellite dish, and we would get to watch Next Generation episodes a week before they aired on the syndicate stations.
Oh, so they were beaming them to the stations ahead of time.
That's right.
And you were grabbing that signal just because, at the time nobody had satellite dish, so they didn't really care.
Right. Yeah. It was all in the open, and there were certainly a contingent of hobbyist satellite TV viewers. It wasn't anything, illegal or bootleg or anything. It was just there were these transmissions that were not scrambled, and you could watch them. So
did you have to? I'm going to ask you about your satellite dish for a moment, just because I've always been intrigued. In the early days of satellite, did you have to move the satellite to get the dish to get these signals, or did you just set it up and then they would get them?
Well, The way it worked was there were multiple different satellites in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to aim the dish to the particular satellite whose programming you wanted to view. Now, eventually, we got the satellite on a pole with a motorized mount.
Ah.
And you could just punch in
coordinates,
and it would tune. It would point the dish to that satellite, and you'd be good to go.
And that's kind of, that feels like a Star Trek-y thing to do, you know, first of all.
Yeah.
You punch it up, and then you hear some whirring. I don't know if you hear it or not, but in my mind, you hear it. And then suddenly, Star Trek is on your TV. That's awesome.
There was some serious whirring. let me tell you. And so that's when I started to really get into Next Gen. It was an exciting thing to be able to see it every week. And so about the fourth season, I started watching faithfully every single week, and we would record the shows. So we ended up with, you know, boxes full of VHS tapes, and of course it wasn't acceptable to put a tape in LP mode, you know, and record 6 hours. You had to have, you know, 2 hour mode because that was the best quality,
right?
And so the number of tapes accrued at an even faster rate.
I have another question about this illicit, non-illicit, but satellite feed that you get. Did it not have commercials in it?
It did not.
That makes it even better.
Yeah, so there were no commercials. If I remember correctly, there were timed blocks in it.
Oh, so they could pop them
in. You'd have, you know, kind of like blank spaces where the commercials would go.
It's kind of like now if you listen, I have a Sonos, so if my local NPR station streaming thing has crapped out, I listen to the national streaming thing, and they have like play like some jazz fusion for a couple minutes when the local station is supposed to be putting in, you know, the news or whatever.
Right. Yeah. And so that was an interesting way to see the show, because you'd also, at the end of the episodes, when they fed, they would also have the packaged promos for the affiliate stations that would lack voiceovers. So they would have kind of like two different versions of those. You'd have fully completed promos, you know, 15, 30 second spots, and they just needed like a station, you know, next Saturday at 7 here on blah blah blah.
Yes.
But then they also had versions of those feeds that had dialogue and sound effects only. There was no music, you know, so it was kind of an interesting way of being able to see the shows.
Now I wish I had a satellite dish when I was growing up.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie, Scott, it was pretty cool. And it even had, I'm digressing way too far on this stuff.
I'm encouraging
you. We
turned it to Welcome to Random Satellite, where I talk to people about satellite dishes.
Yeah. this show would be slightly less popular than a Laserdisc podcast.
Oh, there are Laserdisc
podcasts. But more popular than the Videodisc podcast.
That's true.
We can talk about that stuff, too.
The Betamax podcast.
Exactly.
Which sounds really good, but nobody listens to.
Right. Yeah. But, that's how I got really into it. And in college, Next Gen was kind of this social collective experience. There were quite a few of us who were all fans of Star Trek, and so we would gather around at the dorm and watch an episode every week, and related to the satellite thing, it was very exciting when the final episode aired. They actually held the final episode for they didn't air it at the usual time. It ended up, they broadcast it like in the middle of the night because they wanted to keep it a secret or whatever.
Ah, gotcha.
But I still got it early and,
with your satellite dish,
took a copy of it over to the dorm, and there were probably like, you know, 16 of us watching, the final Next Gen episode, All Good Things, in a dorm room that was only meant to, accommodate, 5 people. So it was crowded, but good times.
Now, I know there are some people who do not like that episode, All Good Things. I think it is one of the best finales of Star Trek ever. So to those people, I say pish posh. It is a fin. Although I should ask you, Jim, do you like that episode?
I do like that episode.
Well, I don't have to say pish posh to you then.
People are certainly entitled to their opinion. In that particular case, their opinion is wrong.
I agree. So your favorite, and we'll get to the episode that we watched today was not from Next Generation. It's a Voyager episode. It is one season 4, episode 25. We'll get to it. But I want to talk about Next Generation some more. And then we'll get to Voyager. Favorite character on the Next Generation, Jim.
I'm going to go Commander Riker.
That is not who I would have guessed. I don't know. I would have guessed Picard just because I feel like that's the default answer. But tell me more of your Riker. So bearded Riker or non-bearded Riker?
You have to go question. Bearded Riker.
That is correct.
Beardless Riker is – that's – if they were ever going to special edition – in fact, they missed an opportunity, really. When they remastered Next Gen for Blu-ray, they really should have given Riker a CG beard. For the first season.
I agree. He looks kind of... I just had this conversation with my wife, not about Riker, but about me. Because I have been, for the last few months, I've been growing out my beard, and it's been kind of crazy lumberjack beard for the last couple weeks. And so finally she said, you really have to trim the beard. And so I said, oh, I could just shave it off. And she said, no, you can't. You look weird without a beard. She didn't say it in so many words, but that's what she meant. And yeah. I feel like, I mean, Jonathan Frakes, I think he's a lovely man. He's an attractive man, but he looks better with a beard.
He does.
And Riker, does. Without a beard, is no Riker of mine.
Yeah.
Except, of course, first season Riker.
Yeah, I cannot disagree with that. And, you know, I like Riker because he's smart. He's confident. He commands the respect of the crew without being someone who is as removed from them as a commanding officer, you know, typically would be.
Right. Because, you know, if you had a problem on the Enterprise – and you needed to go to somebody. You know, maybe there's like an interpersonal problem. You're not getting along with your roommate because, you know, some people on that ship must share rooms. You don't go to Captain Picard because he would not give you the time of day. You go to Riker because he would listen to you. He may not help. He would give you some kind of advice that may be helpful or not, but at least he would listen.
Yes. Yeah. He would probably be thinking about Minuet the entire time.
Probably.
But yeah, he'd be there for you.
He'd take you to 10 forward. You'd order some Synthahol. He would listen. He would sit in the chair the weird way he does, and everyone would be happy.
Yeah. And I think the other thing with Riker is, at least relative to the other crew members of the Enterprise, he is husky. And therefore... My role model for a body type.
Well, I totally agree with that. That is why I always pick not the body type, but the personality type I always pick is Barclay, because I feel like I obviously would be nervous and the least competent person on the Enterprise, which, you know, Barclay actually is competent, but he's just so nervous that he screws stuff up.
Right.
Whereas Riker is never nervous. He's calm, cool, collected. But he does have a couple extra pounds, so that's nice.
Yeah.
But once again, he looks fine. I'm not body shaming Riker.
Not so at all.
Don't write all. In. He exercises a lot. He beats his father up with Q-tips.
Yeah.
He does all the right things.
We are nothing if not body type positive.
That's right. I embrace all the body types.
In the 23rd century.
Yes.
And in present day.
That's right. Yeah. They don't in the 23rd century. They didn't even think about that kind of thing. That's why everybody's wearing spandex, because it doesn't matter. Who cares?
Right. Yeah.
Or that episode where they go to that planet and Wesley Crusher walks on the garden. Everybody's wearing nothing. So, although those people are all super fit, so they don't need to wear anything.
Yep. Yeah.
But anyway, Riker, I say that's a good pick. I like Riker. Let me tell you what's, we'll get to this episode, but, so I've asked you to pick your favorite series. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum and talk about your least favorite series.
I would have to say that Enterprise would be my least favorite. Now, I think there are plenty of good episodes, some very good episodes, towards the end of Enterprise run. In the fourth season, they had some good story arcs going. But there were, I think, probably too many, at least initially, that were just kind of milquetoast.
Mm-hmm.
Star Trek warmed over. And as these words spew out of my mouth, I kind of reflect on the fact that in a lot of ways, Voyager is really just next gen warmed over.
True.
But I think it has enough going for it overall that I would not consider it my least favorite. And I would say in general, too, that I am a fan of all Star Trek in all of its forms. But, I think Enterprise is probably the weakest overall.
I would agree with that. I think that, at least with Voyager, and this is how we can transition to Voyager, there are characters that I really like on Voyager. Yeah. Voyager is not anywhere near my favorite series, but I like Janeway a lot. I can't say the same about Archer. I like the Doctor a lot. I can say the same about Phlox, because I like Phlox a lot. Seven of Nine I like a lot. There is, I guess, maybe T'Pol is the Seven of Nine analog, I guess. I don't know. But
yeah.
And I like her. She's fine. And I like Chakotay. I know that's could be controversial, but I enjoy Chakotay. And there's nobody, then I've run out of people I like on Enterprise, so I can't map Chakotay to anybody, because I can't even remember half the characters' names on Enterprise, which is a problem.
Yeah.
Enterprise is, I've said this before and I'll say it again. I'm not mad at Enterprise, I'm just disappointed. I had high hopes, and, maybe that's part of the reason, right? I think they set themselves up a very difficult task, in that they made it a prequel, and it was the first Star Trek that was going to be filmed in HD, and so, you know, they had all the access to this technology, and everybody had high expectations, and, you know, I think prequels are problematic in many ways, so they had the added thing of they had so much better technology, but yet it was before the original series. And while you watch the original series on Blu-ray, the remastered ones, they look great, but they certainly look like it was filmed in the 60s, because it was. So it's a hard mental break for me watching Enterprise and thinking, oh, this is before the original series, but it looks so much better than the original series. It's hard.
Right. Yeah. Stylistically, it's just so incongruous with the original series. But I can understand the choices that they made in terms of design and sets and, oh, and everything.
I think they did a great job with it. I think it makes total sense. They went with, like, let's extrapolate what it would look like, right? Because it would be generally military people would end up in this, so they'd have military uniforms, so they have all the jumpsuits and stuff. And the show looks great, but it's hard to see that aesthetic evolve into what we see in the original series.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah, we go from the submarine style interiors of Enterprise, and then on Kirk's vessel we now have Technicolor.
Right.
Which it was beautiful in its own way, and actually I appreciate the look of the original series even more now than I ever did. But yeah, I get what you're saying with that.
Yes, and I feel like one of the great things Enterprise had going for it is it had a certain look. The original series, the same way. Deep Space Nine, certainly, has a very different look than any other Star Trek series. Part of the reason I feel like a lot of people think that Voyager is the Next Generation warmed over is because Voyager looks an awful lot like the Next Generation.
Right.
You know, certainly they changed some things, but... It's hard, even and especially the first season, right? They beam down to some planets in the first season, and you think, am I watching a Next Generation episode? There's a gazebo and a fountain and a central atrium. It's like, yeah. it is uncannily Next right. Generation.
Yeah, they have, they definitely have the theme planet village thing going on. But,
yes.
You know, one area where Voyager diverges from Next Generation in a positive way is the existence of interpersonal conflict
mm-hmm.
among the crew. So, you know, the idea of having the crew be a mixture of Starfleet and Maquis was good. And in fact, in the episode that you and I watched, part of Seven's hallucinations and I suppose neuroses about her circumstances kind of stem from the fact that she's not sure how trusted she is by the crew. And then that ends up manifesting itself in her hallucinations.
Exactly. And she has, so 709 is an interesting character, right? Because she's a Borg. She's basically adopted by the crew and she joins the crew. She wants to be very efficient because that's just the way she is. But she is rejecting, she rejected her Borg side. She's rejected her human side. And so that leaves her in this no man's land of what she is, right? And so I think part of her wants to be closer to the crew, but another part of her thinks, well, I can't get too close to these people because they're nothing like me and they will reject me and no one trusts me. And plus they're all idiots.
Right. Yeah.
Which I think that's kind of, I feel like Voyager set up this friction between the two parts of the crew and didn't really do too much with it. There's certainly more intercrew conflict than there ever was in the Next Generation. But once 709 comes along, she kind of blows that whole concept up because she doesn't have, and this episode starts with the Doctor having her in a holodeck trying to practice small talk, basically. And she fails completely because she's not interested in small talk and she thinks it's a waste of time. And so it just turns into her interrogating Harry Kim and B'Elanna about what sports they like and how they ended up in the Maquis and all this stuff. It's an entertaining scene. And more importantly, it gives us a glimpse into Seven of Nine's character.
Yeah, absolutely. And, it's interesting in this episode too, where, there's a scene where Chakotay comes to Janeway and is like, you know, hey, are you really sure you want to mm-hmm. put her in charge while we're all going to be in these stasis tubes? Do you think that, you know, especially considering how she questions you at every turn, that she's up for this? And I think the moment that you get, even though it's not a scene of Seven and Janeway together, the scene of Janeway and Chakotay where Janeway goes like, yeah, even though we do butt heads, I think she can do this.
Mm-hmm.
It really shows, even though this is, you know, fourth season and still early on with Seven being a part of the show and of the crew, it shows that trust that Janeway has, and that you know, if not trust, then certainly respect that Seven earns.
And she also trusts the doctor to kind of keep her on the straight and narrow should anything go wrong, which it does. Dun, dun, dun. So I guess I'll give a very quick overview of the plot because it's super simple, and then we can just talk about some parts of it. So they come across this nebula. They go into it. It's radioactive. People die. One person dies. They don't mention his name. Nobody cares about him that much. But he serves to show us that they cannot go through this nebula the normal way. They can't go around it because it's gigantic and it'll take them a year. Although if they have stasis tubes, I don't know why they don't just go through the stasis tubes and go around it, but that's neither here nor there. They figure out they have to go through it. Seven of Nine is not affected by the radiation. The doctor is not affected by it. So everybody else goes through the stasis tubes. They go through the nebula. Seven of Nine starts hallucinating. The doctor's program starts malfunctioning. Everything falls apart. This mysterious alien appears. You almost immediately know he's a hallucination. Then Seven of Nine has more hallucinations as the doctor's program fails. She doesn't know if she can save the crew or not. She has to divert power from the stasis tubes to get them out of the nebula. But then she shuts off life support. She falls unconscious. She wakes up. Everybody's there. They're outside of the nebula. Everybody's happy. The end. Very reminiscent of an episode of Enterprise called Doctor's Orders, which we covered in episode 5 of Random Trek, in which they are going through a spatial anomaly. The only person who could survive is the doctor. Everybody else is in stasis. He starts having hallucinations because he is. So the interesting thing about Phlox and Seven of Nine that they bring up in both early parts of that episode is that they are used to being surrounded by people, right? So Phlox is a Denobulan, and Denobulans have like billions and billions of people. They're always surrounded by their own kind. Seven of Nine was part of the Borg collective, so she was part of this overarching group mind, right? So it's very unusual. She's feeling withdrawal, right, because she's not part of that anymore, but at least she's surrounded by people. And then in this episode, she's only surrounded by the doctor and people in stasis tubes. So she goes a little crazy. Did I miss anything in my very high-level synopsis of this episode?
I thought you nailed it. That was darn impressive there, Scott.
You know, they don't give a podcast to just anybody. In fact, they do. So let's talk about some – there are interesting things. So the biggest – I like this episode, spoiler alert, just because I feel I like this kind of subgenre of Star Trek, which is – you're alone on the creepy ship, and things that are normally not creepy are creepy, so it's the haunted house, I guess, effect of Star Trek. And I kind of like those stories. My biggest problem with this story is the stasis chambers and why they are never brought up before or after this episode, because I feel like they could really help Voyager.
Yeah, so I had a question about that, and I was wondering if maybe I just missed it because I wasn't paying close enough attention. But did they explain why they have 70 some stasis tubes?
No, I was watching this with my wife, and she was like, "Do they just replicate these?" And I assume they just replicated them, but I don't know. Apparently, Deck 14 has been turned into Stasis Tube Central. And everybody goes into one.
Yeah, I guess so. And the other thing too was they have the thing where Tom Paris is claustrophobic or whatever, and he kind of wakes up out of stasis and breaks out of his his tube. So that's just kind of counter to everything we know about, you know, stasis as medically induced coma, right, essentially. So I thought that was kind of curious, and didn't quite jive with me.
It doesn't make much sense. These stasis tubes don't really keep you in stasis, because they do mention the doctor mentions, oh, yeah, sometimes people just get up and leave the stasis tubes.
Yeah,
and
you think, like, well, do they get up to pee or something? Well, or
maybe we should not call them stasis tubes then. They're just tubes.
Right.
Because they're sleeping tubes. People are sleeping in these tubes. They wake up and they leave them.
Yeah.
Although they do that, obviously, because there's a scene where Tom has gotten out of his, and he should have died, I guess, based on the exposure that he had, but he didn't. They put him back in his tube. And that's just setting it up so that, you know, Seven of Nine starts hallucinating. She hears people saying, help me, and you think as a viewer, oh, maybe someone's gotten out of their tube again. That darn Tom Paris will never stay in a tube. But no, she's just gone crazy. And she's hearing voices. So no, everybody's safe in their tubes, except for the voices in Seven of Nine's head.
Right, right. I thought it was interesting how her first real hallucination, other than the help me stuff that we get a little bit of, was she imagines this this alien coming aboard for assistance with a part or whatever, and he kind of reminds me of this I don't know, to put it in modern day terms, kind of like this weird, you know, Gamergate internet Twitter creeper guy.
Yeah,
and it was interesting to me that his MO was part of her psyche.
Right. He was negging her, as the kids say.
Right. Right.
As the pickup artists say. I watch a documentary. I'm not a pickup artist, but that's the idea that you say bad things about someone in the hopes that they will then react and be attracted to you for some reason to prove that the bad things are not right. So, yeah, this alien says about a bunch of horrible things about Seven of Nine, which spurs her to prove him wrong and save the crew. So I guess it was her own psyche and her neuroses about how she can't figure out things and she's going to die alone, much like Captain Kirk, who always knew he was going to die alone, but he doesn't. And so she runs off and saves the ship or something, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's my two-bit analysis of that.
Yeah. No, I think that makes sense. I'd buy that. The only other thing that stuck out for me as a nitpick on how this story is told is the computer's voice. Mm-hmm. Is done in a way where it basically sounds like somebody's putting their finger on an open reel tape to slow down or speed it up.
Yes.
Whereas I feel that if the Enterprise or Voyager's systems were real, which in fact they are, Scott, Star Trek is a documentary beamed to us from the future. I feel as though the computer, when it was glitching, would probably sound more like Skype problems than slowing down a record player.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
And the one other thing, we spent so much time talking about your satellite that we're not going to spend much time talking about this episode, which I think is okay. It's a good episode. Watch it if you haven't seen it. It's a very simple episode, but I like it has some good effective parts. My favorite part, though, is when Seven of Nine is in the engineering bay area, and she's hallucinating, and all of a sudden, you know, it's lit the normal way, it looks all nice and welcoming, and then all of a sudden it is green and lit like a Borg spaceship, and I thought that was very effective because it takes a familiar setting and makes it alien. And then, of course, that freaks out Seven of Nine because she was Borg and all that good stuff. But
yeah, absolutely. This was a really well done bottle episode, and I liked it a lot because it features two of my favorite characters from Voyager, Seven and the Doctor, and so this one definitely earns very, very high marks in my book.
Yes, and it features a horribly injured Harry Kim taunting Seven of Nine. So I'm always for an episode where Harry Kim is horribly injured.
And practically no Neelix.
And yes, no Neelix. Well, Jim, we have reached the end of our time, and we've given this episode the attention I believe it deserves, and more importantly, discussed early 1980s satellite dish technology, which is what people come to this podcast for.
They certainly do.
That's right. Well, thank you so much for joining me.
It's my pleasure, Scott. Live long and prosper.
And also with you. Next on Random Trek, our second two-parter episode, The Next Generation's Time's Arrow.